Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, here with my brilliant friend.
And podcasting legend.
I mean, legend.
Legend. She is. What are you on the charts now with the focus group? What number are you?
You know, I think I debuted at 12, right up between like Glenn Beck and Megyn Kelly.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
Just where I like to be, all my best friends. But thanks. You know, I was just wondering though, Ben, since I am, you know, obviously I'm having wild podcasting success. You haven't invited me on in lieu of fun lately.
You want to come on this evening?
Oh man, a real time invitation. I think I might. Yeah.
Then you're coming on this evening.
Okay.
By the time you listen to this, dear listeners, Sarah Longwell will have been back on in lieu of fun.
Well, I've got to check with my people, you know. I've got people now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'll check with my people and I'll let you know. But I actually have a much more important thing to talk about. So we teased this last week, I think, or maybe the week before. But, you know, sometimes Ben Wittes is like, am I Sarah's best friend? And JVL is like, no, she's my best friend. But the thing is, in real life, I have a real best friend, Rebecca Frankel. And she just published an amazing book called Into the Forest, she gave me a, you know, a friendship copy, one of those early ones. And I sat down to read it as a, you know, as you would any of your friend's books. And I like never put it down. I read it. And I've been hearing about the book for years. I mean, I've, you know, through multiple brunches, I knew the story that it sprang from and had been through all the research and still had no idea how amazing it was going to be. And the reason that it's actually an unbelievably good fit for this program is, as you know, we all just got done with season 4, which we spent in the woods with the French Resistance. They spent their time in the woods based on Ben and Mai's analysis somewhat poorly on a play that wasn't very good. Becky's book is about real people who lived in the forest during the Holocaust, how they escaped there, how they lived there, how many of them died there. I wanted to have her on the show to tell the story of how she came to write this book, how she put together all this research, and to basically just tell all of you who love this show, I guarantee you, if you like this show, you're going to love this book as much as I did. But Becky, thanks for coming on the show and tell us everything. Tell us everything about the book.
Well, first, I just have to say I'm really excited to be on one of your Star Rising podcasts. And also, I think no matter what I'm going to do in life, that this recognition of being your best friend might really lift up my platform more than anything. So thank you for that as a way of introduction. And I'm so excited to be on here to talk to you about this show because, in fact, one of the women I write about in the book, Tanya Rabinowitz, as she is known as a young girl, but The French Village is one of her favorite shows, and she's watching it now. So I can't wait to get her listening. So what you said is absolutely, you know, spot on. The book took many years of research to write. It was about almost 6, and I have been talking about the story for a long time. And the book is really about one family. This family is the Rabinowitz family. It's we meet a young newly married couple, Morris and Miriam Rabinowitz, just as their lives are flourishing in the small town of Zettel, Poland, in the early mid-1930s. They soon welcome two young daughters into their family, and their lives are about as happy as they can be. And I think a lot of people reading the book will recognize their own families in this. They're very typical in that way. And then, of course, the World War II begins, and their small Polish town is invaded first by the Soviets. And then 2 years later, the Germans, the Nazis come in and take over. And that's when things really start to get bad for this family and for their town. and what happens. And, you know, interestingly, the timing of these conversations sounds about right. But once the ghetto in their town is formed and all of the Jews are segregated and interned in this one area of Shetl, really the only place that they have potentially to go to is the forest. It's for many ghettos across this area of what was then Poland and is now Belarus, is these Soviet partisans who were sort of behind enemy lines after the Soviet army fell to the German army, and they're gathering in the forest, and there's a resistance brewing, and whispers of this resistance, start to penetrate these ghettos, and people begin to think that there's a way out and a way to safety. And ultimately, the Rabinowitz family was able to escape their ghetto miraculously intact, Morris, Miriam, and both daughters. And they ran to the woods, and it's where they lived for 2.5 years. And as I imagine your conversation about this before, it was not an easy way to survive the war, not just because they were Jews, but because they were people living in the woods, running from the Nazis, running from other gangs who were out to kill Jews and Soviets. And because it was terrible, terrible conditions. There was typhus, there was hunger, starvation, hypothermia, frostbite. It was a pretty rough way to survive.
So one of the few things that I don't love about the French Village show is the depiction of the resistance in the woods. And the reason I don't like it is that it is a faintly romantic, picture that is, has elements of deprivation, but, also has elements of, outward bound with fighting Nazis, and my impression is that the actual life in the woods was a matter of extreme deprivation and, was compelled by the existence of the ghettos and the fact that these was often the only way to possibly survive. And so I'm just interested in your sense of whether the existence in the woods for, people who were fleeing the ghettos was profoundly different from what was going on among the French resistance, or whether, whether to the extent the show describes this as having elements of fun, a lot of rehearsals for a play, for example, it's just not actually doing a service to history here.
So it's interesting because one of the things about researching this particular family, the Rabinowitzes, is really how extraordinary perhaps their experience was, because of course, Morris, Miriam, and their two daughters all survived. And it was a very loving family. And so the girls, as young as they were about 4 and 6 when they first entered the woods, were very well protected, where most people of any age were coming in. These families did not come in intact. It was women who had lost their husbands, men who'd lost their wives and children, elderly people who had managed to escape. And so in some sense, these were not people who were extremely well prepared to survive this environment and the circumstances they found themselves in. This particular town was sort of forest adjacent, so maybe they were a little bit better prepared than people who had sort of migrated their way from like really urban settings and cities and stuff. I can't imagine. I can only speak to this experience. I don't know about as much or really very much at all about the French resistance, but it was brutal. There's really no other way to say it. And at the very beginning, when the Jews from this particular town in this area entered the woods, many of them were resistance fighters. They had planned a resistance in this small town that fell apart in the end, which, was very unfortunate. A lot of people were lost because of it. So some of them did have fighting experience. They might have been soldiers at one point in the Polish army, but really they were craftsmen or tradesmen or farmers, and they weren't fighters. And so the Soviet partisans who were establishing a resistance there saw them as completely undesirable. They had no real mission or motive to save Jewish civilians at all. And so it was any alliances that were eventually struck were, reluctant. They were often violent. The Soviets did kill a lot of Jewish civilians. There are stories of, them actually intervening to save them, but I can't imagine that it was anything like outward bound. I really can't.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, were constantly eating chestnut mash and had time to argue with each other over pretty petty things. And ultimately, and then they put on this play that we think is dumb. But the thing about reading the book that struck me, having just watched this season of these guys, is the stuff in your book is so that to live, right? They had to dig. I can't remember what the word is because it's a
Zimlankas.
Yeah. So they would have to dig out underground, mm-hmm. And then kind of build beds like shelves on top of each other. And so they're jamming into these, incredibly small areas that are dug underground, 15 or so people. And so it's things like rampant. And this, the show, for as much as credit as we give it for its accuracy, you immediately realize when you read something like this, they didn't really deal with the fact that there was disease running rampant, and they probably would have been among these communities, but people getting typhus, and they were all in these close quarters, but just how bad too it would smell, and people would die. The part that I've, it's gonna haunt me, but and they couldn't make any noise. And so anybody who was noisy, especially crying babies, they weren't going to make it. They weren't going to. And so the survival level of intensity, the humanness of all of it, really stands out when you're in the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty incredible that they survived this at all. I mean, really, not just people who are there to join the fight, but people who are just in the woods, like this particular family who actually worked very hard to stay away from all of the partisan activity, because the feeling was among Morris Rabinowitz, who eventually became this group's reluctant leader, he didn't want other families around them. He said, we should all go our separate ways. It's safer if we're, the smaller we are, the better off we are, the less likely we are to draw attention to ourselves. And in fact, he said, later after the war, that if he had known what it was going to be like, he would never have gone in. It was that bad that even though they survived it and they, went on to live very happy lives afterwards, another extraordinary part of their story, that it was just that terrible. And so, to your point about what you said before about plays or people making noise, I mean, a lot of people, I read stories and testimony for survivors who, there are groups that they people who reunited in the forest and they were happy and they built campfires and sang songs and they just magnified the beacon of, their where they were. And it was a very unfortunately foolish thing to do, but they didn't know that there were people out there hunting for them. They thought when they got to the forest that they were safe. But to sing songs and to, make any kind of sound like that was just a way of amplifying their existence and where they were. And it got a lot of them killed.
What do we know about the numbers? When we think about the classic survivor story, right? It's an urban or, small town Jew who is initially crowded into a ghetto and then, deported usually by train to a camp, selected for work, and kind of rings it out over time. This is a different story, right? People who kind of escape into the woods and just kind of live there, either with a partisan or resistance fighting component or not, until the war is over. What do we know about how many Jews survived the war by camping out in the woods?
I mean, that's a really interesting and great question from my perspective, because it ties into just the way I was forced into doing research, which is to say that very little is known about the numbers. And I think, you know, we will never know how many people came in, because in some ways, in hiding in the woods, they were hiding from all the mechanisms of history keeping that were, you know, deployed at the time. They weren't in any army. They weren't rounded up in any concentration camp. The Nazis kept meticulous records of this. And so it's really hard to get a sense of who exactly made it. And then, of course, the people who perished there, we don't know about them. We won't really know about them. And if the only real source of this information is in survivor testimony. And so when I first started, you know, how is it that you start researching a book? You go to other books, you go to archives, you go to documented resources. And when I first started doing that, I found very little readily, you know, at my fingertips. And so what I had to do in order to build a real sort of a journalistic kind of a timeline to verify the testimonies and the interviews I was conducting with survivors, the Rabinowitz family daughters, was to listen to as many accounts as I could, and then sort of piece by piece take the information I was finding. And it was really, you know, maybe even 2 years into it that I was starting to understand even what were the right questions to be asking about this experience. And so what we do know is largely built in terms of numbers, yes, from survivor testimony, but from perhaps Soviet records that were kept later. It's sort of like the absence of numbers that gets us close. So I think it's determined that there are about 10,000 people in this part of the woods, in Poland and Belarus and Ukraine and parts of Russia. 10,000 people who survived, not the people who went in. It's just the amount of people who went out. And that's a rough estimation that was conducted by scholars and people who were collecting testimony, like Yitzhak Arad, who was part of Yad Vashem, you know, in the early decades after the war.
So, you know, one of the things that I knew going into the book from knowing you was that you got the idea from, because your rabbi's wife, mm-hmm. like the rabbi you grew up going, like his wife is the daughter in the book.
Right.
But what's crazy is that other people, and you know what, it's sort of like how I'm watching The French Village for the second time and I constantly forget about things and then I'm surprised by them again. In the book, one of the most moving parts is actually in the afterword, where you explain how you came to tell this story at all, right? Because your point just you made about how this is such an undertold story that there's actually not even that much information about it. But the reason you got the idea was because you know this person personally, and because there was the love story between that sort of drives the narrative, which unless you think it's a spoiler, you should tell. I mean, it's sort of right up front in the book.
Right, it is. It's right in the prologue. So, you know, my family is Jewish. I grew up going to Hebrew school. Rabbi Philip Lazowski bat mitzvahed me. He bat mitzvahed my sister. He presided over my grandparents' funerals. I mean, the Lazowski family is a family that I grew up knowing almost as well as my own in some ways. They were just sort of always there in the background of our family events. And so Rabbi Philip Lazowski married Ruth Rabinowitz, who is the oldest daughter of Morris and Miriam. And their paths crossed as children because Rabbi's family was interned in the same ghetto. His family was from this town called, a village really, called Belitsa, Poland. And when the Nazis invaded, they pushed everybody out of this village and they forced them into the Zhetel ghetto. And so what ended up eventually happening in the spring of 1942 is the Nazis conducted their first selection, which is like what you were talking about before, Ben, which is they rounded up all the Jews from the ghetto and they separated out the people who held any sort of value to them. And they peeled off the elderly, the infirm, women without husbands, frail men without working certificates, and they eventually took them away and they killed them. And it was during this selection that Miriam Rabinowitz was there, at least at first, with her husband, and they got separated in sort of this pulsating, very anxious, upset crowd because it was a massacre. People were getting beaten. People were getting killed right around them. And so there she was by herself with her two young daughters, Ruth and Toby, or Rochel and Tanya. And Philip Lazowski, as an 11-year-old boy, was in the same selection. And he was entirely separated from his family, and he was there by himself. And he understood very quickly that he was not going to survive this afternoon without some help. And he started to recognize people from his own village in the line, going up to this one single point where there was this Nazi officer who was basically deciding people's fate based on either their work certificates or just on a visual recognition of whether or not they would be of use. And he said, you know, please pretend that I'm with you. I'm here without my family, and no one would help him. And so he sees this woman standing with her two young daughters, and he sees that she's holding a yellow work certificate, and he just thinks that she looks like a nice lady. And he goes up to her and he says, will you please pretend I'm your son? And she decides in a minute to say yes. And she says to him, you know, if the Nazis let me live with two children, they'll let me live with three. And so they go through this line, and their plan is successful. And because she has a work certificate and her husband's already made it through the other side, they go through this line and they're saved essentially from this initial selection. And then it's many, many years later, and I won't tell too much of the rabbi's story because it's in the book, but he's at a wedding in Brooklyn, and he's sitting at a table, and he talks to this young woman, and it turns out she knows the story of a woman from Jeddah who saved this boy in a selection, and it's a friend of hers, and so she tells the story, and it turns out the story she's telling is the one Miriam saving him. And from there on, he reconnects with the family, and then the second love story of the book, the one between Ruth Rabinowitz and Philip Lazowski, is ignited and begins from there.
And I just got to say, so the way that the book is structured, where you tell that story, so you get a lot of all the texture in the middle of the story, but the basic framework of that is set up right out of the gate.
Yeah.
And so you start the book with the kind of chills that is like of just when the most amazing twist of fate occurs, and makes people's lives sort of whole in a way after decades. And and one of the other things that it does, and I'm just going to tie this to the French Village somewhat too, is that, you know, Holocaust fare in general can feel, maybe even especially in this moment where a lot of people are, you know, just not as connected and locked down and anxious, can feel like, oh, do I want to read more about the Holocaust? Do I want to watch a show about Nazis? And in both cases, you know, the show is sort of adjacent to a lot of it. And it really is personal stories, and it makes what is historically accurate and an incredible period of time tolerable. And also like very interesting. And the thing about the book is that for all the hard stuff that's in there, and there's a lot of hard stuff, because there's this both happy, connected family at the center of it, as well as you sort of know they make it, and they're extremely compelling. You never feel like it's like a wonderful story. Yeah. You spend the whole time feeling incredible about a lot of it.
I mean, totally. And I don't know that I could have written this book during the pandemic and a very divisive political time in our country without sort of having that sense. You know, it was actually comforting in a way, because, of course, over all the research and interviews I did, I kind of fell in love with this family because they are extraordinary people, but also this love story and the fate of it. And in some ways, it's just their ability to not just survive, because that's not what they did. They did a lot more than that, but just they went through this period. They lived in the forest. They survived the Holocaust, and then they come out and they do so much with their lives. And you know, it was very wonderful for me to be able to put some of that in the book. It's not just about the Holocaust, right? It's not just about what they endure, but it's about what they overcome and then what they enjoy. And it's, their lives are so joyful. It is really very uplifting. And I hope that people, you know, who read it come away with the same good feelings that you do, because I imagine, yes, just diving into a show about the Holocaust, diving into a book about the Holocaust, it might feel a little bit weighty. But there's so much more to their story than that.
Rebecca Frankel, my great friend, congratulations on your book. I would also just like to, I'm just going to throw a couple other things out here really quick, which is, it is I wouldn't have recognized this, I don't think, if I weren't like an adult now who spent time around people who do this kind of research. The amount of research that it clearly took to put something like this together is nothing short of a triumph, because you feel the whole time like you're there, like you understand what's happening. And to reconstruct something like that, you know, it's not fiction, it all happened, is incredible. And I'm just really, really proud of you. And it's an amazing book and I loved it.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, I was so happy to be here. You guys are great. This was awesome.
Thanks, Becky. All right, Ben. So that was really fun, but let's talk about the show. What'd you think of this pair of episodes?
So it's an unusual pair of episodes for the show because it's almost entirely focused on a single plot line. You know, usually with a French Village, you're bouncing between, you know, four or five different concurrent threads. But here, basically, everything disappears except this showdown at the school between the militia and the resistance, and the story of their surrender and then their trial becomes essentially the entirety of the show.
Yeah, it is weird. I was thinking to myself, well, this is a great day to have Becky on, because it's not like we've got, you know, seven different intersecting plot lines to break down. There really is. They're at the school. The militia has hunkered down. They are just trying to decide between blowing up the whole block with all the dynamite in the basement or surrendering in some way, or, you know, fighting their way out. It's unclear. Then the big thing that happens in this episode, we have a couple characters show back up. The biggest of which is Berrio, who...
Welcome back, Berrio. I'm so happy to see him. And I'm excited he's back. I'm really relieved that he's survived. He's not well received by his wife, who is not excited to see him, but I am happy to have him back. And I was reminded, particularly in the wake of the death of Marie, that Berrio, whom I started out disliking pretty intensely because of his ham-handed romantic efforts, is one of the great characters of the show, one of the characters who basically always does the right thing, including in these kinds of in these episodes. And I'm just thrilled to have Berrio back.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see him when he gets out of the car. He is showing up now as the substitute prefect, now that De Caverne, our other returning character, is in the school being held hostage, his strength slowly draining from his body, only to be revived with Kurt's blood, a blood transfusion from Kurt, which Lucien doesn't want to do. But Berrio shows up, and it's funny. There's a bunch of things that happen immediately upon him showing up that I think are worth kind of breaking down. First thing is, I think he looks fantastic. His hair is gray, but he's got it. You know, he used to have this like dorky kind of slick back hair.
Yeah, he doesn't look dorky anymore.
He doesn't look great. He looks distinguished and handsome. And, you know,
the war has done well by Berrio.
That's right. And he's got a little silver fox thing going on. And then it is weird though that he shows up at the school to announce that he's the deputy prefect. And he doesn't like go check, see his wife and kid first. Like he just like pulls up in a black car and is like, I'm here.
Well, to be fair, he can't go see them. They're being held hostage.
That's true. But I guess he doesn't know that. And it's just, I mean, if I were returning after many years, I think the first thing I would do is see my spouse and child. I don't know. That could be me.
Maybe. I mean, he's got to fight a war. But I just also, the contrast between his return and De Caverne's return is pretty striking. De Caverne comes in immediately, you know, picks the wrong fights with the local heroes, you know, reminds you of all the aspects of him that we don't like very much. Berio shows up. The first thing he does is diffuse a situation that could blow up the center of the city. He does it like he shows up. He makes all the right calls. He negotiates in a productive fashion. Turns out they've got the place wired to explode. They don't know that. He just does it all. He's just a good old-fashioned good guy.
Yeah, with like good instincts. He knows that they'll trust him. He seems to, you know, he doesn't show a lot of fear, sort of just like walking up to the militia to start negotiating. You know, he's pushing back in the right places, but also, you know, later in the episode where, or it's, I think the beginning of the following episode where he's sitting down with all of the leaders, you know, he knows who to give a little something to, and, you know, they just
lay the commies off against the Gaul. I mean, he's got good political instincts.
He does have good political instincts. But I will say just one other thing about like when he first shows up, that is the way, so Lucien is like taking injured Kurt like across the courtyard where they lock eyes. And the thing that reminded me the most of is the way that Marie looked at Lorraine, whatever her husband. But remember when like he showed up back from war and you could just like the look on Marie's face was like, why are you here? And she, you know, she was shacking up with Schwartz, no interest in seeing him. And Lucien had that very same look on her face.
Yeah, although I gotta say, I have seldom disliked Lucien more than in this couple episodes. I mean, all right, I get why she makes this arrangement with Berio and agrees to marry him. And like, she needs protection. It's 1940. She's pregnant. I get it. Marriage of convenience and all of that. It's not his fault, right? And then he goes away patriotically to serve the resistance. And he comes back. She's shacked up with the gasping mummy. And all of a sudden, this is all his fault. She's terrible to him. And I just think like, okay, you make your marriage of convenience. Like this is this is what you wanted, girl. I don't know. I'm really not.
Sort of, except Kurt is there. So like Kurt's, so here's the thing. So there's two ways you can read Lucien. And I was like, there's the part where I'm watching her and thinking to myself, like, oh, God, she hates him so much. She's so mad he's back. But then I also, when they go to have the conversation, right, they're, like, in their apartment and they're having, you know, he's trying to be like, well, you know, this is what I did and I'm back and how are you and why are you so unhappy to see me? She has to eventually, they don't actually show her saying it, but it becomes clear she told him that Kurt, because he's, like, figuring out, he's aware he's not sharing a bedroom with her. And so he's trying to figure out where he's going to sleep. And in doing so, she sort of says that there's somebody in the other bedroom. And I guess it occurred to me that much of her reaction could be fear as much as anything else. Like both she is not happy to see him, but part of that could be like, now she's got to explain that she's harboring Kurt.
I guess. I love his reaction when they finally have the conversation. He's like, look, you know, he doesn't say it this way. I love you and everything, but I understand you've got priors with the mummy. Don't get in the way of my political career. You know, he basically like, you know, falls back to all right. I knew I never really had a chance with you when I suggested we get married, but I do have a chance to be mayor of Villeneuve. And you know, you with the German soldier, please don't screw that up.
Yeah, because there's two negotiations that goes on with Berio. There's Berio negotiating with Lucien, and then later Berio negotiating with Larche. And his negotiation with Lucien is like, okay, we are going to figure out now how to do the second half of our marriage of convenience. And it is that you better be a good political wife, and I will ignore that you've got a half-burned German in the other room that you're in love with and prefer to me. And like, we're gonna, because you're, and this, it does, something that is clear in these episodes that I think counts as foreshadowing, although I don't quite remember exactly what happens, is how justice is coming for the women who were messing around with Germans. And so like the level of danger to Lucienne for harboring a German who is this, you know, the father of her child is not insignificant. And it's there for Hortense too. We don't know where Hortense is right now, but we know because Berio and Larchet have what begins as a subtle exchange of blackmails to each other and turns into a much more straightforward set of mutually assured destruction that they both voice, which is Larchet knows that Lucienne is harboring a German, which obviously would derail Berio's political career and hurt Lucienne. And on the other side, Larchet knows, or I'm sorry, Berio knows that Hortense was with Mueller and basically is saying, I could help her in my new role as mayor of Villeneuve. And it occurs to you too in that moment that Larchet was the mayor. Berio wants to be the mayor.
Yeah, so a couple things on this. And before I forget, a note on possible historical inaccuracy on the piece, on this. Larchet's, you know, manages to save de Quiverne with Kurt's blood because of a blood type tattoo that Kurt has that they notice. I think this is a very weird thing because my impression of the blood type tattoos is that they were really limited to SS people, which we are led to understand that Kurt is not. He's kind of an enlisted soldier. And so the question of like what the show is trying to suggest there, whether they're actually suggesting that Kurt is an SS guy or whether they're suggesting merely that he's, or whether they're just taking a liberty and suggest, you know, having a regular German soldier with a blood type tattoo. I'm not really sure. That said, he is, you know, like he's a danger to both of them, right? Larchet treats him furtively. He's, and meanwhile, this great resistance figure is harboring a German with a blood type tattoo in his attic, you know, and so there is a kind of mutually assured destruction thing going on, although frankly, neither of them's done anything wrong. I mean, Kurt is, you know, Berio is, if anything, a kind of victim of, you know, marital infidelity, and but he's not the one who was harboring Kurt, who was actually, you know, checked into that particular hotel before he showed up, and Larchet, you know, treated an injured person, and by doing so had access to a blood transfusion that saved the prefect, and so I actually think they're both in a dangerous situation, but it's not because either of them has done anything horrible or infamous.
Yeah, I mean, that would be quite a scandal for the incoming mayor, for his wife to have been, so, you know.
Not to mention for the outgoing mayor, you know, that he was, you know, secretly treating
soldiers. But here's the thing that I would say that is interesting that sort of ties these two episodes together, all the plot points and the conversation we were just having that I think is interesting and seems relevant to the moment that they're in history, which is the entire two episodes are one big set of negotiations, right? Because the entire world has been reshaped and they're trying to rebuild it. And so there's the negotiation going on between the guys at the school and the resistance members who are all staked out, ready to blow each other to smithereens, but they are also going through the process of negotiating. Barrio shows up to negotiate with them. There's the negotiation between Barrio and Larchet. There's the negotiation between Lucien and Barrio. And, you know, there's the negotiation between Larchet and Lucien and Kurt over the blood. Everybody's kind of like in this new space and trying to figure out how to navigate it. And I
think there's the negotiation over the trial.
And the trial. Totally. Totally. And because everything is being, yeah, thrown into this new space, right? So everybody has to figure out where they fit. And there's this line, it's actually Barrio and Edmund are talking about the resistance and the Gaullists, right? Because they're negotiating how their relationship's gonna work. And Edmund says, you know, we're going to need a marriage of convenience. And Barrio says, those are the best ones. It's a great moment.
Like,
yeah. Ties the room together, really.
So I think the fundamental negotiation here is over what to do with these militia, right? And it starts out when they're threatening to blow things up. It's basically a combined hostage situation where they can blow up the downtown too. But then it turns into a negotiation in the context of a trial over basically is being in this uniform per se evidence that you should be shot, which is the position of the government when Barrio calls and reports on this to his superiors. You know, anybody in that uniform should be shot by tomorrow afternoon. Or do you have this kind of individual level responsibility, which is what, which is what Larchet asks for? You have to prove that each one of these people did something. And do you just say, hey, this group is guilty, which is what Edmund and Anselm are suggesting in the context of a trial? Or, as Suzanne suggests, is the standard, like, if they have blood on their hands, we shoot them, otherwise they should go to prison, right? And so you're having these different visions of how collective guilt is, how individualized it is, and they're starting to present all in the context of these, you know, 15 or so militia guys.
Yeah. And actually, so I had written down one question. So I want to dig through this particular piece, because to me, it's at the heart of the episode, at the heart of the show, at the heart of all the episodes we're about to have going forward, which is, what do people deserve based on what happened? So I wanted to ask you specifically, they're very focused on Albin, and for good reason, right? So Albin, we've seen in the show before, and he was in the woods briefly. He was with Antoine, so he was with Antoine briefly. He made a choice to leave the woods. So instead of being in the resistance, he ended up in the militia. Both he and Antoine, very similar paths. They're both trying to get out of the, you know, forced labor that they're being sent to in Germany. He ends up on the militia. And then we see him at the beginning of the season murder two children. And we've seen him struggle with it ever since. We also see him not... He sees Antoine and Suzanne hiding out at her ex-husband's house, and he doesn't turn them in. And it becomes clear as you kind of follow him through these episodes that the Godfather guy had an incredibly pernicious effect on him. He's dying over the guilt, and yet doesn't want to die. Like is in fear for his own life. And so I think that they've given us enough information about Albin that we as a viewer going into this can make a judgment. And they put him, because he's the most difficult one, right? So we've got the leader of the militia, and he knows he's going to die, and we think he should die. He led the militia. Then there's like the kid who just joined 2 weeks ago that Larche mentions, just put on the uniform 2 weeks ago, and you're like, oh, are we going to shoot that guy? I mean, like, I don't know what else he did, but that seems like maybe he should be given different consideration. But then there's Albin, the I'm just following orders guy. So my question to you, Ben Wittes, the complicated moral one is, does Albin deserve to die?
All right, well, let me preface this by saying that I am not a believer in the death penalty. So I, in order to have this conversation, I have to put myself in the shoes of people who, for whom that consideration is not on the table, in a revolutionary justice kind of situation. I don't think it's a close call. The show gives you a lot of reason to be sympathetic with Albin, not the least of which is that he has a very warm relationship with his sister, and he's clearly feels guilty and he's torn up about it. But look, this is the definition of a war crime. And if the distinction that you're making is that, you know, we're not going to decide people on the basis of status. We're going to decide on the basis of what people did. Shooting two children in cold blood is the, like, what more could he have done that would, and the only redemptive feature is that he feels bad about it. Well, Marchetti feels bad about it too, you know? And so there are a lot of people whose guilt is regrettable because under other circumstances, they may not have been terrible people. But under the circumstances in which he lived, he made a series of choices that made him a genuinely terrible person. One of them is that he didn't like being ordered around by Antoine. Well, that actually turns out to be not a good reason because he ends up getting ordered around by a much worse person than Antoine, who's a murderous, crazy person. And so he becomes a tool of a murderous, crazy person. And if you're going to say that the standard is we're going to shoot the people who did horrible things and committed war crimes, really hard to see how you forgive him. What do you think?
I 100% agree with you. My objections to the death penalty, like in the United States, has a lot more to do with how it's implemented, applied, the mistakes that can potentially be made. But it doesn't mean that you couldn't show me a person who has raped several people, murdered, tortured people, and I wouldn't say if I knew for sure it was that person, I would be okay with it. Like, there's a difference, I think, between like a systematic objection because of how things, because it's not utilized particularly well. And then there's a difference between, okay, well, what is just for an individual who's made certain decisions? And I think for Albin, he made a choice, and it's a choice that, and the thing is, you know, to what end do you execute people in this particular context? Like, what point would his death serve? Well, they are trying to reconstitute a country whose moral sensibilities were turned upside down, whose sense of right and wrong was completely inverted. And they've got to correct that. And, I see Larche's, whether it's a defense mechanism or whether it's, because of his own complicity, or whether it's the humanist in him that does not have the kind of bloodlust that you see from a lot of the villagers. I understand that. And I do think there are in this episode, and there's going to be parts as we do suss out the justice of it all, there's going to be bloodlust that makes us really uncomfortable. Right. And there's vigilante justice that, you you know is coming and that I have deeply complicated feelings about. But in this case, just Albin, I think we have enough information to make a moral judgment call about what should happen to him.
Yeah, and look, you see the harbingers of the vigilante justice with a would-be mob with Servier in this episode. That's controlled for now. But look, I mean, Albin murdered two children a few hours ago.
Right.
You know, it's like, and, you know, whatever one thinks about the death penalty in contemporary America, no country in the post-war era that had a major collaborationist issue to sort out after the Germans left issued the death penalty, by the way, none. You know, and the, you know, not even Norway. Norway hanged Vidkun Quisling. You know, these are, the death penalty was a part of the justice apparatus for all of these countries. And I think there's a, you know, if you're going to be executing people, there's no case for sparing Albin.
Yeah. You do see, though, or maybe I'll ask, I shouldn't say you, but I see the complicated, how complicated it's going to get very fast in terms of pursuing justice with people. And when you see, you know, Antoine seems to be struggling with it. He knows Albin. He's got some context for Albin. Albin did save his life. You know, these are people from the village, and many of them, many people want them because they're from the village to be killed and hanged, just like they stood by and watched Marie and all those other hostages get hanged. But of course, other people know them and probably saw them as little kids. And so one of the things that Antoine and Berio seem to want to do is to, they're trying to evacuate them, to get them somewhere else to be judged. And I think that that's one of the interesting things about this episode is Berio trying to restore the democratic mechanisms that allow for kind of, you know, a justice that is a little blinder, a little less based on people's passions. You know, he wants them to be judged, and they would probably be judged and given death penalty by a jury elsewhere. But they're reluctant to do it by the people who were closest to it and who are angry and are looking to take exact revenge on the first person at hand.
And in trying to set up a reasonably fair process, he ends up setting up a very ad hoc process that kind of makes its own rules as it goes. And he's dealing with a command authority that he's on the phone with that says, we want them all shot tomorrow. And so he's got some, you know, some serious headwinds.
Yeah. I mean, so what was your reaction because they end the second episode with that, the commander from Dijon saying they've got to all be put them, I want them up against a wall in 24 hours and executed. And Berio's like, we're going through this whole thing. And I think he was hoping, he wants obviously many of them to be given the death penalty. Like that is the point of a lot of this.
But he wants a process that he can say, I set it up and I didn't direct its outcome. I made a little speech about how important it was at the beginning of the trial. And then I, you know, let the trial happen.
Can I just say really quickly about the trial? Was there any part of you when you started to see the trial take place that reminded you of the cockroach trial?
That's interesting. It didn't. But now that you mention it, it's kind of at the same level of procedural seriousness.
Well, it's so funny because when Berio is like, will you be the judge and you be the prosecutor and you be the we need a defense person. It's like the exact same deliberation they had in the jail where they were like, well, who will be the judge? Who will be the jury? And yes, and ultimately it's about the same level of like sort of serious deliberation.
Except that Larcher wins the first point very importantly. He establishes that they should be judged individually, not collectively, and that there has to be evidence about that they did something.
Yeah. And I did actually love, as cockamamie as the trial kind of is, and there's banging and ringing bells and shouting back and forth, the ability for them to, in good faith, Antoine and Suzanne, to hear Larche's point and say, well, obviously that's correct, but I don't know what to do about it. You know, but you know, that the idea that people can's logic could prevail is very much part of any good judicial system. And you can see it in a ham-fisted way sort of working, in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are... This was an organization that only the previous day or 2 days earlier, whatever it is, had just, you know, provided security at the hangings of a bunch of hostages. So, you know, it would not be lawless to say, hey, you participated in a war crime of taking civilian hostages and murdering them. You may not have been the person who ordered it. So I don't think the idea of some measure of status guilt there is it's not really status guilt, because you're not just saying, hey, you are saying this person participated in this event, which is itself, you know, murderous. And but that said, Larche is clearly right. And the point, I suppose, is that the moment you allow any process, it is actually disciplining.
Yes. And I am, as much as I feel certainty that Albon should be mortally punished for his crimes, so too, part of what I love about this episode is that reimposing of restraint. Because that seems like a necessary component to rebuilding a civilized society. And that balance between ensuring that justice is delivered so that people understand that the moral order has been restored effectively versus an accompanying, you know, a real process, due process and everything else, like that, striking that balance is such an interesting exercise to think about what people were doing in those years.
And this played out at a, you know, at a very high level as well as at the ground level. So, the famous story about this is that both Stalin and less totalitarian Winston Churchill wanted to deal with post-war justice through summary executions. And Churchill famously said that he thought there would need to be 50,000 summary executions of Nazis. And, first Roosevelt and then Truman, importantly, insisted on trials. And that's where the Nuremberg trials came from. And Truman was serious enough about it that the person appointed to be the chief prosecutor who wrote the rules of the tribunal was, Justice Robert Jackson, one of the great justices of the 20th century. And so, this is a very local kind of dramatization of a dispute that was actually taking place at the highest level of politics, and that resolved in somewhat the same way that this resolved. And by the way, the Nuremberg trials acquitted two of the senior Nazis, Franz von Papen and Hjalmar Schacht, to a lot of people's surprise, were both acquitted by the Nuremberg trial. So if they let, the young person who only put on the uniform at least off of the death penalty, that will be sort of also consistent with the way the highest policy was carried out with respect to to the most senior people.
Yeah. Well, I am excited that we're moving into the justice phase because it's going to allow us to sort through a lot of stuff, which to me has always been the point of the show.
And to really be unfair with the analogies to modern times, like, you know, who is the equivalent of the, I don't even know his name, the wiry-faced commander of the militia, and who is the equivalent of the new recruit who only put on the uniform 2 weeks ago.
I don't know. I mean, this is where I always think analogy, like the analogy with the Nazis is so much about the psychology of standing by while something bad happens. And also seeing power shift and jumping in new directions that even you know are morally wrong, but you're willing to trade it for power or all of the, like those things are a lot of those psychological aspects I think are good analogies. Cause like the thing I think is I'm always like, well, I don't think this is like Nazi Germany. It's only that what I see happening is I could understand the psychology of how it did happen. Watching modern politics over the last few years.
Yes, all Nazi analogies are wrong.
Yeah,
they're analogizable to nothing. They were unique in their degree of evil. That said, studying them is a great way to study the phenomenon of evil.
That's right. That's right. And so there's a few other just quick points I want to hit here. Kurt asking Barrio to help him die is interesting. And
convenient for Barrio if Kurt just didn't, you know.
Can I just say this is a little bit mean, but there's part of me that like Kurt is just imagining a future where he can say nothing. He can basically lie there and Lucy Ann's just gonna like talk at him and he's just like, kill me now. Like, I don't want to, there's, it's, anyway, it's all very sad.
It would be like a focus group.
Yeah, it might be. And then the other character who's back, Ezekiel Cohen shows up. Nice to see him again.
For Sarah Meyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Ezekiel Cohen shows up and actually it's a pretty moving scene with his daughter. His daughter survives the war. Thanks to Mercati, who also has done some good things alongside being a thoroughly evil motherfucker. And of course, he explains to Rita that, you know, they're there thanks to Mercati, not knowing that that was either just what she needed to hear or just what she didn't need to hear at that particular moment.
That's right. And well, what's crazy about him telling her that story is that neither of them know, but we know that he let them go because he was working off his guilt about sending Rita's mother to her death. And so that Rita is the reason that they were given that weird reprieve.
And Mercati still hasn't figured out that lives are not fungible. You know, like if you kill one person, like it doesn't erase it if you save a different person.
Yes.
Just want to say that's like a problem, like a moral logic problem that Mercati is like having trouble with.
It is. And I think this is where the show wants to complicate things for you a little bit as you adjudicate people's culpability. By making them do good things as lots of people would do, or show regret or whatever. But this is where I still find myself, but they show you what they did. So, you know, and this is why none of the analogies, like, I don't know who the equivalent is of that person because I don't know who the person is who is actively going around shooting, right? There's nobody right. They separated children from their parents, and that was really bad. And people stood by and watched that.
They weren't engaged in a broader project of mass murder.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. That said, the Mercatis were real. The people who, you know, who had one foot in the, you know, had relationships with resistance people and were feeding them information and, you know, but were also monsters who were, you know, deporting people. That stuff really happened. And, you know, the people who came out of the war with, you know, lots of people who would vouch for them and also people who thought of them as the butcher of Villeneuve that's a real thing. And, you know, Klaus Barbie is a famous example of that. He had, you know, resistance people who would vouch for him.
Yep. Okay. I think we're going to need to wrap it up. There might be a couple of things we've missed here, but I think we mostly got it.
Berio's back.
Berio's back. It's justice is coming. It's going to be great. Well, thank you all. You should all go buy Becky's book. It's really excellent. Ben, as always, great to see you.
Great
can't
to
wait.
See you. You should come on In Lieu of Fun this evening. And Edith, you should come on In Lieu of Fun this evening, except for the whole being dead thing. So instead of that, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme s'aime tous les